Yep, he's planning another project. So this Father's Day at Lowe's, tap into free gifts for dad. Get a free select Craftsman power tool when you buy a Craftsman V20 charger with 2 amp hour and 4 amp hour batteries. Plus, get a free DeWalt power tool when you buy a select 20 volt max XR 4 amp hour battery kit. Dad knows our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 7/14 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Vietnam, the war in the 20th century, a crisis, a tragedy, remembered by those of us who lived through it. I was not in combat. I was not a member of the military. And that fact is important to understand about a generation now called boomers who lived through it with an understanding incomplete of the decisions made in Washington, in Moscow, most especially in Hanoi. Victor Davis Hanson is here, writing most recently at American Greatness, in admiration of a second volume in what will be a three-volume set about the Vietnam War by his colleague Mark Moyer at Hillsdale College. We're looking at lessons learned all these decades later. And I'm the first volume is 54 to 65. This is the second volume, just issued, 65 to 68, including Tet. So I'm most engaged to go immediately to an image that the author gives and that Victor reproduces, which is LBJ as Hamlet. It's wonderful to consider, shall I or shall I not, to be or not to be. How so, Victor? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening. John, LBJ always claimed that he did not want to escalate into Vietnam, that the Kennedy, who had been assassinated in November of 63, had escalated and put 10 to 15,000 advisors, so to speak. But he inherited his brain trust, the best and the brightest, specifically Robert McNamara as his Secretary of Defense and Henry Cabot Lodge as the ambassador to Vietnam. And then the Bundy brothers that had various appointments in the State Department, McGeorge Bundy and his brother. And they said that, you know, this was this. They had a point. They said that the Soviet Union was going to undermine South Vietnam as they tried to do in South Korea. We had stopped them in South Korea, and that had resonated with the Philippines, with Japan, with Formosa, Taiwan, Australia, and we had to do the same in Vietnam, and that would save Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and by extension, Indonesia, Philippines again, and Singapore. So that was the idea. But no sooner had he done that in early 1965 that there were restrictions put on, as you know, in the Cold War. And one of them was not to bomb the North, not to bomb Laos or Cambodia, and not to pressure Thailand, where they were being supplied openly by both China and Russia, they being the North Vietnamese. So my point is he didn't know what to do because he was at the same time, John, trying to fuel this enormous great society, all these isms and ologies and alphabet soups we have today. And it was a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar project. And so his guns and butter, he was getting nervous. And once the death toll started and we were losing a lot because we had the restrictions on our soldiers, the people who had advised him to go in there, McNamara especially, but also the Bundys and also later Clark Clifford, they were telling him now to get out. And he didn't quite know why they would have told him to go in and why they get out. And they had been behind the assassination of the government under Diem, which was really the only non-military figure in South Vietnam that we could trust. And we had supported a coup and perhaps even the assassination of him. And so Johnson, in these conversations that have been taped that Mark Moyer relates, is a Hamlet figure. He says, should I send more? Will I be, are these people like McClellan? Or are they going to, is the left going to challenge me? Can I trust Avril Harriman and these people that were Kennedy people, are they leaking back to Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy in, by 1968? And he didn't know what to do. He had good instincts. He knew that he should just take the gloves off and either win or get out. And he listened. And Walt Rothschild told him that, one of his advisors, as well as a couple of other people. Dean Russ told him the same thing, but he didn't listen to them ultimately.
The first volume covers 54 to 65, and I want to go in two directions, Victor. I remember, as you speak vividly, the Tonkin Gulf construction, August of 64, yes. Before the election, yes. Which LBJ won overwhelmingly. But that construction, Robert McNamara and LBJ vouchsafed what we know now to be falsehoods. Did that weigh on Johnson, this Hamlet-like figure, that he had deceived the American people to win their support in the election, and that the deception continued in many instances about how the war was presented, why we were fighting?
I don't think moral issues like that approach were of interest, were evident in anything he did. He seems to be not immoral, but amoral. He wasn't, and I'll give you one example. During the 68 election, news had come to Johnson. He thought that members of the Nixon campaign were talking with President Thieu in Vietnam and were colluding, so to speak. An early example of collusion so that the South Vietnamese, who are now finally represented in the Paris peace talks, would be holdouts. They would say no concessions. And because we know Nixon's coming in, he may win. And there was no evidence that anybody in the Nixon campaign had talked to anybody in the South Vietnamese government. And yet Lyndon Johnson ordered wiretaps and wiretapped Spiro Agnew, the vice president candidate, and wiretapped other people. And he found nothing. He never found any. And now we finally think maybe Madam knew, the widow of Claire Chennault, and maybe Madam knew, had been, you know, bragging on a telephone that they had contacts with Republicans, which they really didn't have. They were just boasting about their inflated influence. But my point is that Johnson, it didn't occur to him to there was anything wrong with wiretapping his enemies or his opponents. One last thing very quickly is he was very Hamlet-like about Hubert Humphrey because he decided that he would not run, and he announced that, and then he started to look at the opposition, and Robert Kennedy jumped in, and Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy were fierce critics. And then Humphrey had no choice, so Humphrey started to criticize Johnson, even while he was vice president, and was demanding a bombing halt coalition government. And Johnson, on these tapes, is in this Hamlet situation where he rues that the people on his side are against him, and Richard Nixon, from what he said on the campaign trail, would start to be Johnson-like. He would be the Johnson that Johnson never could be. He says, you know, you have to bomb them to force them to the peace table, and Nixon's got it right. But it's almost as if I wish I was on Nixon's side because they would support me and my own people will not, and I have to endorse them. So it's kind of very complex what was going on.
I look forward to both volumes. I've ordered them now, thanks to you, Victor. But let's come to another Hamlet moment. This is January of 68, January into February. The Tet Offensive. We're told many years later that knocked Johnson out of the presidential contest. Everybody was assuming he would run again. He could at the time. There was no reservations on him. He'd assumed the presidency after the assassination of John Kennedy. However, Tet sideswiped him. And in late March, I remember, Victor, we can all remember, there I was at college watching a TV, and the president was making a speech, and I will not run was a shock to the nation. Was that Hamlet himself being Ophelia, throwing himself in the water? How is it regarded?
Yeah, I think so. He wanted to run. He was determined to run. And he had compared himself to Truman that had inherited an administration from his predecessor, and Truman had been unpopular and run for re-election in 48 and won, and Johnson thought, I'll do the same thing. But then as the campuses exploded and people in his own party were running against him on one side, and Nixon was you know, going to run and saying he was weak on the other side. He felt that he was trapped and that he was going to be, a statesman, he thought, that he would be above politics. And he thought the North Vietnamese would respond to that. And what he learned very quickly is that for all of his intrigue at Paris via Avril Harriman and others, the North Vietnamese had no intention whatsoever of ever agreeing to a split Vietnam along the Korean model. All they were pure Stalinists. There was no such thing as Uncle Ho. They wanted to absorb all of Vietnam as quickly as possible. The only reason they went to the Paris Peace Conference and agreed to it was because Rolling Thunder, the first bombing wave under Johnson, was extremely successful, according to Moyer, and had devastated North Vietnamese in the field and their supplies. And they wanted a year and a half to regroup. And they thought they could do that by dragging out the peace talks. And Johnson knew that. He knew it instinctively. And he said, but he knew that he couldn't continue because his own party was not viable, even when he didn't run. And so he is kind of a tragic figure. One of the things that very quickly that Mark Moyer shows is I always thought that linebacker, the Nixon bombing in Christmas of 72 that had smart bombs, laser guided bombs, and went after the people in North Vietnam, especially the cadre in Hanoi, were so much more effective than the earlier massive area bombing. But he shows that the early bombing was very costly, but it was very effective. And it's kind of an ironic situation where when you get the transcripts from Johnson and all of his advisors are saying we're losing, we're not doing well, except the military. They didn't say that. But at the same time, Moyer's producing the transcripts from Hanoi. And they're saying, oh, my God, the Americans are just destroying us. They're destroying us. They're destroying us. We have no chance unless we stop the bombing. So that's very ironic.
One detail I look forward to learning in the book, the ideology of the moment. February of 1968, Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. I remember attending a rally at the University of Pennsylvania. There was a feverish feel in the room. It was jammed, and every word McCarthy had to say was worshipped. It wasn't particularly vivid. I don't remember the senator's speech. But Johnson, was he weighed down by the left on his own in his own party, or did he shrug it off?
No, he was not only weighed down, he felt betrayed because while he had sent people like Harriman to the Paris peace talks, he found out through his informal system of surveillance that Clifford and Harriman, supposedly representing the president, were having back channels to Bobby Kennedy and the anti-war movement and undermining him both in Washington and at the Paris peace talks. They were completely, especially Cyrus Vance comes off very poorly, Jimmy Carter's later Secretary of State. They were giving concessions to the North Vietnamese to be able to brag that they were the anti-war people and win the 68 election, that Johnson didn't even approve and didn't even know about until post facto. And one of the really sad things is that we always thought that Westmoreland, I can remember at UC Santa Cruz, the students called him Wastemoreland, that his search and destroy missions were suicidal. They had killed. But Moyer very strangely says, I mean, we all thought Creighton Abrams was the savior who came in 71, but he shows that the search and destroy missions really prevented any mass concentrations of North Vietnamese soldiers and allowed South Vietnam not to be overrun. And by 68, they had 1 million people in the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam. So they were doing pretty well. And this search and destroy were only discontinued because they were pretty effective. And this casualties came not from the search and destroy, but the inability to stop the very sophisticated supplies. And I had no idea, John, that there was 100,000 Chinese actively inside North Vietnam and 10 to 15,000 Soviets that were manning aircraft and aircraft batteries. It was more than a proxy war.
Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, writing an American Greatness in a volume I look forward to, an assessment of the Vietnam War. 55 years later, there's a war in Europe when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
What happened to her, Mario? How could she simply disappear after she was with you?
I don't have answers for that.
48 Hours at CBS News present.
I'm just going to ask you straight out. Did you kill Christy Wilson?
No, I had nothing to do with her disappearance.
Another season of My Life of Crime with Erin Moriarty. Award-winning correspondent Erin Moriarty brings you face-to-face with killers.
I will never say that I'm a cold-blooded killer. I will never say I'm a murderer.
And the people they took from.
My son died running for his life.
This season, follow the evidence with Erin, beyond the speculation, including in the death of boxing legend Arturo Gatti.
My gut says I don't think he would take his life.
I know my husband killed himself.
Listen to My Life of Crime from 48 Hours on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm David Pogue from CBS Sunday Morning. In the new season of my podcast, Unsung Science, you'll meet the discoverers of Ernest Shackleton's shipwreck, Endurance, lost beneath the Antarctic for 100 years.
It looked like the day when it sank. It's just a very good environment down there to conserve a shipwreck.
The woman who invented forensic genealogy and has solved over 150 cold cases.
It's controversial, right? Because you never know if sitting around your Thanksgiving table, there's somebody who's been getting away with murder or rape.
And the NASA engineers who flew a helicopter on Mars.
The density is 1% that of Earth's. 1% air density. It sounds impossible, and it is almost impossible.
It's season 2 of Unsung Science, presented by CBS Sunday Morning and Simon & Schuster. Listen to Unsung Science on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.